I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Nearly 2,500 people in the past three decades have spent time in U.S. prisons for crimes they did not do. Most of those exonerated in Missouri have never seen any compensation for the time they lost. One wrongfully convicted Kansas City man is free after spending 23 years in prison. Today, he'll share his firsthand perspective and tell us what he thinks should be done to help others like him. Then, as the Kansas City Royals transition to new ownership, we take a look at the impact of the Glass family era. The team saw a lot of losses and some big wins. Is there any momentum for the future? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. After 23 years in prison, Ricky Kidd is a free man. Kidd was freed from prison in Cameron last month. That came a day after a DeKalb County circuit judge found that the original trial was unfair and that the evidence was clear and convincing that Kidd was innocent. The judge gave the state of Missouri 30 days to decide whether to retry him. On Friday, the state agreed to dismiss the case. These days, Ricky Kidd is attempting to get his life together. He's now working as the community engagement manager for the Midwest Innocence Project. That's the same group that worked to free him. Part of his mission now is to prevent wrongful convictions from ever happening again. The state of Missouri, meantime, will pay Kidd nothing for his years of wrongful incarceration. That's different than Kansas, which in 2018 became the 33rd state to agree to compensate those who are wrongfully convicted. Ricky Kidd joins me here in the studio, and welcome. So nice to see your face. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be seen.
Yeah. With them today is Tricia Bushnell. She's the executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project. Tricia, nice to have you too.
Thank you.
So, Ricky, how are you?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm really excited to be back in society and be a responsible citizen and embrace the freedom that should have never been taken from me in the first place. Mm.
What's the toughest thing you've had to figure out so far? I mean, the toughest thing about reintegrating into society, which is the social studies fancy term for it.
For me, I think it's been keeping up. In a prison setting, things are a little slow. Mm-hmm. Life out here moves in real time, and it moves fast, as does driving on the highway. Everybody's speeding.
So does it seem real fast?
It's fast. It's been real fast, and I haven't done bad. But I could see where others or many people probably struggle trying to keep up because I feel it, just not as much as others, perhaps.
Must be pretty tiring.
It can be. At the end of the day, you are tired. You are worn out. I was just telling my attorney, Trish Bushnell, that it's rewarding, though. It's rewarding to have the opportunity to kind of piece my life back together. And then this next leg of working with the Innocence Project and helping others. So it's a rewarding tire at the end of the day.
You know, I was thinking about you and this whole idea that while you were in prison, you missed this whole technological upheaval we've had in society with smartphones and the computerization of our lives. How much is that difficult for you to wrap your arms around?
Not as bad as I thought. I'm probably at about 30-40% right now, being out about 30 days. Mm-hmm. And I just was offered an opportunity to learn more about computer and technology classes that I'll be taking soon. And so it's been different. It's been different. None of this stuff was out when I was out. And it's been fun, kind of like a toy, too. So yeah. I feel like a kid that just left Toys R Us or something.
Were there computers in prison?
There were computers in prison. And I did have the opportunity to work in an office setting where I had some exposure to computers. And then recently the DOC allowed us tablets. So I had the opportunity to really kind of navigate around working a tablet, which has helped with my reintegration and connection with these devices.
Well, Tricia Bushnell with the Midwest Innocence Project, What do you make of the way this case wound up? How are you feeling yourself about the way the justice system handled Kidd's case and the final leg of it?
I mean, certainly it's always frustrating to see how any of these cases go for Ricky or anyone, that it takes so long and that anyone can fight it. You know, one of the things when we look at a case is, can we actually prove innocence? And we can't get into a court and file unless we have the evidence that proves innocence. So the fact that we could be fighting, and in Ricky's case, fighting since 2009 with the state about whether or not he was innocent, is just it's frustrating.
What was the fight over?
The fight is almost always over what's called procedural bar, which are of these, are you even allowed to be in court right now rules. And that's what I think is so disheartening, is folks don't usually ever fight about the evidence. The state's not usually out there saying the evidence doesn't say they're innocent. They usually don't speak to it at all. What they say is, you should have filed before, you should have done this before, you missed your chance, or you already had an appeal. All of these procedural things that take years and years to fight about. I mean, Ricky's habeas petition was filed in 2015, and it took 4 years to get an evidentiary hearing. We were fighting about whether or not we could have a hearing, whether or not we were in the right court, whether or not. And instead of just looking at the evidence that was there and bringing him home.
Oh, help me understand why the state would approach it that way. I mean, the justice system is all about, in theory, doing the right thing, even acknowledging a mistake was made. So why do they fight so hard?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is, the system up until trial is about a presumption of innocence and justice. But once someone is convicted, the system really shifts to finality over fairness. It says, we don't want a floodgates issue. We don't want people to be having appeals forever and ever and ever. And so all of these laws were passed to keep people from being able to appeal. So when the state can just win by saying you shouldn't be in court, they don't need to address anything else. And that's what the argument gets caught up about over and over. Now, as to why any particular office or attorney general or prosecutor's office would fight without looking at the merits, that's really up to them and their office and us as voters to hold them accountable.
Do those rules need to change?
I mean, I think a lot of us believe that they should change. If we could just look at the merits, first of all, right? If we could just look at whether or not someone's innocent instead of arguing about, should you have filed this appeal 10 years ago or not? Like, what does it matter?
Yeah, why doesn't that happen? Why? I don't understand why that's a stretch.
So what really happened is, in 1996, President Clinton signed this law, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which really just changed federal habeas and the habeas system generally. And that's the type of appeals that we do. And it essentially says you get one shot at your appeal. If you miss it, too bad, so sad. You don't get to come in. And if you didn't put everything in, too bad, so sad, we're not going to hear it. And so when you have states like Missouri, where you have a completely overworked public defender system, or you have people who are filing appeals without a right to an attorney, those issues don't get put in there. They were never investigated. They were never put in. And so no one ever heard it. And so now when somebody comes along and does all of the accurate work, gets all of the evidence, the system's like, you've already had that chance.
So when we argue then about funding for public defenders, this is one of the huge consequences of not giving that system more money.
Absolutely. It is costing people their lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head. You get what she's talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a direct correlation in my case that for Missouri's failed public defender system has played a direct role in what created this in the first place.
I mean, what kind of interaction did you have with attorneys who came from that system, Ricky? I mean, how did that work for you?
It was next to none. She just simply did not have the time, energy, or resources to dedicate to a double murder case where I was – where the consequences, if convicted, was life without. And so I think I had seen her in that period, I think a 10, 11-month period, maybe two or three times. If I stretch it to four, and maybe in 15-minute increments, even if I stretched it to 30 minutes times four, you're talking 2 hours to adequately defend a first-degree murder case. That's just that's unspeakable, and something needs to be done.
You know, I know the question, I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but how do you keep going? You know, when you know, you know the truth in your gut, and you're trying to, you know, get through this experience, you're in a system where, if in my limited experience in interviewing prisoners suggests that everyone says they're innocent, so there's nothing special about you saying you're innocent. How do you, you know, keep pushing to get through from day to day when nothing's happening?
Yeah, well, first, I'm a man of faith, and so I would have to say that. But aside from that, what is the opposite, Steve? The opposite is to give up.
That's right.
Relinquish and dwindle away, spending the rest of your life in prison. And so there was times that I wanted to give up, but I did not want to spend the rest of my life in prison for a crime that I did not commit. And so I had to. There was no other option. In fact, on the outside, I used to show a strong face, but on the inside, I was weary and really concerned about what some of the things that Trish talked about. Mm-hmm. But I cannot subscribe to it because it's like quicksand. If you stay there too long, you'll sink in. And first it's a toe, then it's a leg, then it's your upper torso. And before you know, your head is barely sticking out, and it's hard to get out of quicksand. So I just refuse to stay there. And by faith or blindly or naively, just continue to believe that my day would come. And I would have to add to the end of that, lawyers and supporters who never gave up on me. So when I wanted to give up, they wouldn't let me because they was there. I lost 11 times before we won. And they, even if I wanted to give up, just give me a hint that I should give up. Like, go away. Tell me that you're done. Tell me you're not working with me anymore. Mm-hmm. And just maybe I would have considered it, but they never did. And so that helped as well.
That's just remarkable. We're going to pause here just for a moment. When we return, more with exoneree Ricky Kidd about life since his release from prison. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Ricky Kidd, who spent 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. So where are you living, and how are you sort of pulling your life back together again?
So I'm staying with my sister. She opened her house to me to come home. And little by little, I'm piecing it together. Mm-hmm. I was, in the first 30 days, I was able to get my driver's license, my state ID, my Social Security card, my birth certificate, a bank account. I was able to get clothes on my back, a nice little closet full of clothes where I can get up and go to work every day or do the things that I need to do. I'm enrolled in medical services. Mm-hmm. Counseling services will be coming up next week. And so that's little by little. I'm piecing it all back together and with the love and kind and support of family and strangers. That's been possible.
So, Ricky, when you leave prison after 23 years, what do the authorities give you as you head out the door? I mean, you got clothes. They give you clothes. They give you money. You get anything?
You get nothing, Steve.
Nothing.
Absolutely. You don't even get an apology. You get nothing. Nothing at all. And but so I
none of the guards you got to know sort of shook your hand and said, Ricky, I'm really sorry about what happened to you.
I may have had a couple of those.
Okay.
But that doesn't.
The warden didn't come down and say, on behalf of the state of Missouri, we're sorry.
No. Nobody has said to me since I've been out, on the behalf of the state of Missouri, we're sorry. And here's what we can do for you.
So how did your fellow inmates regard you when the word came down the pike that you were going to be released because you've been wrongfully convicted? How does that change the social dynamics inside the prison?
Well, for me, I was popular for all the right reasons. I ran programs inside prison. I was a positive role model for a lot of inmates. And so hearing that I was being exonerated, everybody within range was excited.
They cheered for you.
Oh, absolutely cheered for me. A bunch of
you're a rock star in the prison.
Rock star in the prison, just for the type of how I did the 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling like it was deserving for me. In prison, usually is a negative setting, a negative environment. People really don't care. I'm not going home. Who cares? But mine was different. They really wanted to see me make this journey and make it to the other side. And so hearing the news, it was a lot of hugs and handshakes and jubilee walking me out the door. So that part felt good.
They clap as you headed out the door
time? They absolutely clapped. And then phone calls. So since I've been out, they've been calling me. I mean, I probably received maybe 3 dozen calls.
Are they saying, what's it like? How you doing?
Just excited. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of what you're doing. You look good. Freedom looks good on you. Regular clothes look good on you. Some of them are saying, don't forget about us. Some of us who are innocent back here continue to tell people about wrongful convictions, things like that. So, yeah, it's been encouraging.
As you look back on your time, you know, what needs to change in that system? What needs improving?
On the inside?
On the inside.
On the inside, more rehabilitation. For me, Steve, my thing was growth and development and freedom. And I needed both of them to go hand in hand. Because if I was exonerated without the growth and development, then I was 21. I didn't want to come out. I'm 45 now with a 21-year-old mindset. There was things that still need to be developed. Prison offers some of that, but not in full scale. I had to do it by myself.
I was going to say, to what extent is self-initiative really what it takes?
Self-initiative is what it took for me. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Grit and determination to do better, to want better, to turn my negative into a positive. I think on the inside, they could participate a little more in helping guys reintegrate back into society, whether they're innocent or whether they're guilty. The reintegration part is important. Post-release is important because you don't want anybody, again, whether innocent or guilty, return to a society if they're not ready, because then they could turn around and be a detriment, or they can be a tumor on the body of the state opposed to an asset to their community. So,
what programs were available to you? What did you take advantage of on the inside?
Oh, one of the first programs I took was called ICVC, Impact Crime on Victims class. And although I was innocent, I wanted to understand choices and how I made choices. I was innocent of the crime, but I was guilty of poor lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to look at that. And so that's one of the first programs. I love that program. It led me to other important programs, Mastering Yourself, Healing Feelings, Criminal Thinking, Alternative to Violence, just really understanding, not just for myself, but for others around me. And so I went from taking programs to creating, to facilitating programs, to actually creating programs with inside the Department of Corrections.
You know, speaking of that, when you were released, the Jackson County prosecutor here, Jean Peters Baker, made a point of defending the original case against you. She said in a court filing, there is evidence connecting Kidd to the murders. She said you had knowledge of the plan to the real perpetrator's plans to rob and murder the victim, and that was also based on your contacts with the perpetrator in the days before and after the murders. What about that?
Yeah, I think she embellished the facts to kind of suit their position in light of everything.
And what the state had done.
And yeah, exactly. And what the state. So much of that, in my opinion, is embellished. There was an element of my awareness. Growing up in the inner city in a community, if you tell or get too involved with the police, it could have resulted in me losing my life. So there was a piece in transparency of information that was that I wasn't forthcoming about, which didn't make me guilty. And with the totality of the facts that has now come to surface, once I read that, I thought that was kind of shameful. And I've given her credit in part for doing the right thing. I had not read that yet. But when I read that, she knows that it doesn't jive with everything else that's fully come out. And so I just think I kind of smirked a little bit. I thought maybe that was a little coverage for them. So,
Trisha, with the Midwest Innocence Project, how jacked up was Rookie's case?
I mean, I think you could say lightning hit multiple times for everything to have gone wrong. You know, Ricky had an alibi, but unfortunately was never fully investigated, not only by the police, but also his defense attorney. There was
how can that happen? People hear this. You hear it. You see it in the movies. How does that happen? It's 2019.
Well, I mean, there's two parts to that. One is when law enforcement believes they've already got enough to make their case. Sometimes they're like, why would I go out and disprove my own case?
Okay.
And the answer should be because you're searching for the truth, right? Not things to fit your theory.
Right.
And then in the case of the public defender, I mean, it's a resources issue, right? If they don't have the time and they don't have the investigators, and because they don't have a police department working for them, if they don't have those folks able to go out and collect that evidence, time is of the essence and it goes away, especially in an alibi, right? You can't go back and collect some videos that don't exist anymore. And you can't start going back and talking to witnesses how many days later. And then if they do remember, they're still subject to being cross-examined because they didn't get asked until how many days later, right? And so Ricky was also left in a situation where he's trying to reach out and find these witnesses that he knows is there that his public defender hasn't reached out to, that the police haven't gone and talked to. And then the response is, well, now you're talking to them, so clearly they're lying. Even though the reality is nobody was doing what they needed to do. And there was absolutely evidence from day one of who really committed this crime. There were three people who committed this crime. Right. They alibied themselves together. They were renting the car that was seen leaving the crime scene together. I mean, everything that was known should have pointed to them.
And one of them has since acknowledged that Ricky wasn't part of this.
That's right. So Ricky was convicted with another man named Marcus Merrill. And since then, Marcus Merrill has come forward and confirmed what the evidence showed, that he and the two individuals that he was flying in from Atlanta with had committed this crime together.
But you were still in prison, Ricky.
I was.
This stuff's coming out, and you're still sitting in a jail cell.
Yeah. Hard to believe. It was very hard to believe. So the facts, as Trish was saying, for the most part, was intact, just wasn't presented to a jury. And then when Marcus Merrill came forward in 2008, I thought, oh, this is it. It matches with everything. This isn't some game or gimmick of a guy trying to get out of prison.
Right.
There was weight to it. There was weight to it. And I thought that following year 2009 that I would be exonerated. It took 10 years.
What triggered the Midwest Innocence Project getting involved in this case, Fisher? I know you have so many cases you're looking at. What was it about Ricky's case that stood out to you?
So Ricky's case was started by Sean O'Brien, who's a professor at the UMKC School of Law, and he's one of our founders of the Midwest Innocence Project as well.
He's been here any number of times. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so when he started working on Ricky's case in 2005 and then in 2009, he brought the Midwest Innocence Project along, and so we've been working on it with him ever since.
Yeah. I can't help but wonder, Ricky, what your fellow inmates in prison, do you suspect that any number of them are also innocent? Do you have any feel for your friends that who are still sitting in cells?
I feel very certain that I've come in contact with men who are actually innocent. And I do hope to look them up or have them contact me and maybe work towards exonerating them as well. Absolutely. There are a number of individuals who I feel strong. There's a number of individuals who I believe should stop saying it too, because it hurts the cause when everybody continues to say I'm innocent. So I do not like that. I don't believe everybody is innocent, but I do believe there's a number of individuals who are, and we need to start doing something about it.
I will say one quick fact with that is, while there is this public persona that everyone says they're innocent, people don't tell us at innocence organizations they are innocent. And in fact, we get a lot of family members who call and ask for applications for their loved one that never send that application in, because they do not tell us, because they know we will investigate and we will look for it. And so if you look at the statistics, you know, there should be about 3,000 to 7,000 people in our region of five states that would be actually innocent. We only have, I mean, it sounds only, we have a wait list of about 600 people, which is far below that. People don't say that to us because they know we will figure it out. So It can be important to say that in social settings that are very different, but they aren't necessarily using the resources of innocence organizations.
Ricky, the state of Missouri doesn't compensate those who are wrongfully convicted, even those who spent 23 years in prison. The state of Kansas a year ago changed that. What needs to happen?
Some compensation bills need to get passed, and we need to be bold and courageous, and we need to do what Kansas is doing, or what Kansas has done over there. And really, and it's easy because they've done it already, and we can really just look at their framework, bring it over here. They're our neighbor, and really just have the courage and the gall and the forethought to actually sit at the table and do something about it. Quit looking at the elephant in the room and get them out of there. So,
Tricia, the state could pass an appropriations bill that compensates Ricky for his time. Is there any effort, any movement in that direction as we sit here today? The legislature doesn't meet till January again, but yeah.
Right. So not currently, but I think that's something that folks are certainly talking about and thinking about. Ricky's spot on. Missouri does currently compensate people who are exonerated by DNA evidence.
But he was not exonerated by DNA evidence.
Right.
So we exonerate some of those who are wrongfully convicted, but not everybody.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. Hard to believe.
Yeah,
just absolutely stunning. Hard to believe. Ricky Kidd, welcome home. So good to have you here
today.
So good to see you doing so well.
Thank you,
really
Steve.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Tricia Bushnell, Executive Director with the Midwest Innocence Project. Always appreciate your time and your work. Thanks so much. After we come back from a short break, we're going to talk about the legacy of David Glass, the longtime owner of the Kansas City Royals. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. You're missing out if you haven't signed up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. You can do it at kcur.org/Kraske to get insights from me and highlights from the show delivered to your inbox each Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. The host of Kansas City Week in Review has covered American politics for more than two decades. So how did former BBC reporter Nick Haines end up in Kansas? You'll have to join us on tomorrow's Up to Date to find out. That's Wednesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the Royals' proposed sale is led by Kansas City and John Sherman. It's getting mostly positive reviews based on what we know so far. That's raised questions about the legacy of the Glass family, which has owned the team for 20 years. That legacy includes, on the plus side, a World Series championship offset by season upon season of 100 lost teams. Now a conversation about the positives and negatives of that legacy and what this means for the Royals going forward. With us, Greg Eklund is a sports reporter for KCUR. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Toby Cook is here. He's the vice president of publicity for the Royals. Toby, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Well, there's some interesting history here, Greg. How did David Glass come to own the Royals to begin with? Because I know Mr. Glass had conversations with Ewing Kauffman before Mr. Kauffman died about owning the team, and Mr. Kauffman told him to hold off. Why did he do that?
Because at that time, and this dates back to probably around the 1980s, Mr. Glass has said that he was first interested in owning a baseball team in the 1970s. He became acquainted with Mr. Kauffman, and it was probably in the 1980s when Mr. Kauffman sensed that there was a brewing labor situation, mm-hmm. when things were getting a little bit more on the unequal side between the large markets and the small markets. And indeed, then there was the strike of 1994, which wiped out the World Series that year. And it wasn't after that the ownership thing then started becoming a clearer picture for the Royals.
So Toby, Glass held off. He became the Royals chairman of the board until the team found a new owner. Where did the ensuing search take the team? And I'm thinking about a man named Miles Prentice.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about him.
Well, I hadn't thought about Miles Prentice for many, many months, and then Greg and I were chatting before we went on the air. And remember that guy that wore the suit and the baseball cap? Miles Prentice was vetted by Major League Baseball to be the new owner of the team in the late 90s. And we were talking about the then Commissioner of Baseball, Bud Selig, who got everybody together and said, the Royals need to look at different options.
Right.
Now, I had moved to Kansas City in 1998, and I had heard all of these stories from afar about the Glass family and about Miles Prentice, and I was just a fan at the time and kind of following along. But I think that there was, at some point, a feeling that David Glass was destined to own the team. I don't know what that means or how that was put together in the ensuing time when the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation was running the club after Ewing Kauffman's death.
That's right.
And that was a strange situation for everybody. It was strange for Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. It was weird for the staff. It was hard for the people in the clubhouse. We had a situation where we didn't have an owner in Kansas City for many, many years for the express purpose of keeping the Royals in Kansas City.
Right, right.
Because it was a part of the idea from Mr. K that he was going to keep them here.
What was the issue, Greg, with Miles Prentice?
I think at that time, because in the big picture, Major League Baseball had seen an upheaval of ownership at several franchises. The Reds had undergone an ownership change. The Athletics had undergone an ownership change. Disney had owned the Angels at the time, and they were getting ready to sell. So Major League Baseball is trying to get some stability on the ownership side, and I think they questioned the financial wherewithal of Miles Prentice at that time. And I'll never forget that Toby got it right. I was at the owners' meetings in Cooperstown, New York at that time, and I remember when Mr. Selig said that he told, and the other owners, told the Royals to seek other alternatives.
Wow. How would Miles Prentice have changed the trajectory of the team? Any sense, Toby, as you look back? Too hard to say.
Too hard to say, only right. because I've only seen the Royals through the lens of the Glass family owning the
Right.
I came on, I joined the Royals in the front office about 5 weeks after Dayton Moore did. So I've gotten to see it from and Dayton has even said this before, not the ground up, but below the ground up. And I've only known for the past 20 years and for the past 13 years as an employee, the glasses. For me, the Miles Prentice thing was quick, and then it was, you know, it was endorsed, and then it was over, and we were back on to Mr. Glass.
So he's turned down. David Glass steps back up. Why was he willing to step back in at that time, Greg?
Well, at the time when he was chairman of the board of that foundation that was running the Royals at the time, Glass thought that, in his words, that it would be divisive around Kansas City if he was to suddenly become the Royals owner. So once Miles Prentice was turned down by the other owners, that's when David Glass said that he had a change of mind at that time.
We have
a
cut from him talking about some of this at the time. Can you want to set it up for us?
Sure. And that was the question. When David Glass, after he was approved as owner in 2000, he was asked why he was willing to step it up once again after he thought it was divisive.
I believe that changed. And I got encouragement from many people to rekindle the interest that had that had really not gone away, but something that I wanted to do from the beginning. And then when we had the problems in getting approval on the process we just went through, then I in my mind and heart knew that it was the right thing for me and the right thing for the Royals at that point in time.
You know, we're talking about the legacy of the Glass family's ownership of the Kansas City Royals. At that time when he took over, Greg, what was the hope for David Glass's tenure as owner of the Royals?
Well, obviously, I think the hope was for that him to have the team for a long, long time, because all anybody was looking for was stability for this franchise.
And keeping it here
in Kansas City. And keeping it here for the long-term future.
He was a Walmart executive. Was there any question then that he would be tight with a buck? Because that's obviously a lot of what his legacy looks like today.
Well, let's put it this way. He'd run the Royals like a business and not like a toy, because you had other major league owners freely spending their money on free agents and in the open market. And he was a little bit more conscious because of the place that Kansas City was in the overall landscape of marketplaces. And he applied some of his retail principles to the operation of the ball club. For instance, so when you're no longer handing a ticket to the ticket taker upon entrance to the stadium, you're getting blinged going into the much like you do at a cash register at your retail outlets.
He said in 2000, David Glass did, that he believed that Kansas City was in a better position to compete with baseball's large markets because of the new luxury tax. Let's listen to what he said about that back at the time.
You're never going to get Kansas City equated with the revenues of the New York Yankees, for example, but you're going to get enough attention to this competitive balance thing that smaller revenue markets will begin to field much more competitive teams.
So was David Glass right?
To a certain extent. You're still going to have the disparity between the New York Yankees, the Los Angeles Dodgers, but they face a luxury tax now. What you have, which has been refreshing the last few years, with the Royals included, what you have now are more teams like the Minnesota Twins, the Kansas City Royals, and others from your medium or smaller markets that are able to field teams that can be just as competitive and win, as the Royals did, a World Series.
But Major League Baseball, Toby, is not nearly as even-steven as the NFL. Why not? I mean, why not bring competitive parity through financial parity to Major League Baseball? Just the owners holding that up?
I think it's in the DNA of Major League Baseball, where in order to be a Major League Baseball team, you have to operate as a franchise of Major League Baseball. But there's been a premium put on the owners having a lot of autonomy in their revenue. It doesn't mean that there isn't revenue sharing in Major League Baseball, not just the luxury tax, but if somebody buys a New York Yankees cap in Alaska, 1/30 of it goes to the Kansas City Royals in terms of some of the royalties. Mm-hmm. There's revenue is spread out, but it's just been a part of baseball for as long as we've had baseball games, that owners seek autonomy even though they're looking also to be identified as a part of a greater entity, which is MLB.
You know, arguably, Greg, this market has paid an enormous price for the philosophy that Toby just laid out there.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. But Kansas City has also had its share of benefits because of what Toby had just
in
laid
what
out
way?
Too. Because of some of the money that had not been coming to Kansas City in the past, until they changed some of those policies with the sales revenue of Major League Baseball merchandise.
Yeah. So Toby Dayton Moore, the current general manager, came on the scene in 2006.
Correct.
That was when you came aboard, and that's when the team immediately began to turn around.
Right.
And I'm kidding.
I take all credit
for that. Yeah.
Yeah. For the rally in November of 2015.
How unusual is it for a general manager like Dayton Moore to stick around for as long as he has with one team?
Very unusual.
Very unusual.
You talk about the players of the 70s and early 80s with the Royals and how unusual it is now for guys like George Brett and Willie Wilson and Frank White to stay with a team for as long as they did. Different economics of their own contracts for a general manager. You know, Carl Peterson was with the Kansas City Chiefs for, 21 years?
Mm-hmm.
And that was unheard of. And at some point, 21 years was the time that he moved on. Dayton was a Royals fan growing up. He grew up in Coldwater, Kansas. He ended up with the Atlanta Braves, but I think that it was too big of a deal for him to pass up on this idea of coming here. And once he created what he called, and this was a very big deal for us on the business side, a model organization again, like we had in the 70s and 80s, the attitude on both the baseball and the business side, he had so much fun with that and became such a part of the community that I think he wanted to at least give it a shot at doing this all over again.
He clearly has a special relationship with David Glass, the two of them.
Yeah, they talk a lot from what I understand. Dan Glass, who's my boss, he's the president of the team, David's son. He lives here in Kansas City, and he runs the day-to-day operations. And the three of them talk all the time. But I think there was a desire on the part of David and Dan, and I've heard this from both of them, that, you know, they describe themselves as a family who was excited to own a baseball team, but they were more baseball fans than they were baseball operation experts. And after they got their legs underneath them in the early 2000s, I think that they felt like the key was that Dayton was going to transform the entire organization, and there is a special relationship.
You know, David Glass bet that playing small ball, that is the team built on speed and stealing bases and stellar defense, was the way to win in Major League Baseball. You know, Greg, he was right in the middle part of this decade, he and Dayton Moore. But is he right today because he's sticking with that style of play at a time when home runs are getting hit at all-time record levels and the Royals aren't doing that?
Well, the ballpark doesn't lend itself to a lot of home runs, with the exception of what Jorge Soler has done this year. But that, you know, balls are flying out everywhere. I think that really, I think David Glass has embraced really what Dayton Moore has, because I think that's more of the manager and the field manager's vision of what kind of team they want to put on the field. And I think
they can afford.
Sure. And David Glass is the one who eventually signs off on all that.
Let's just run through how you would grade the Glass ownership years, Greg. If you had to talk about baseball on the field, what would you say? We're going to run through these pretty quickly here.
Okay. On the field, I would say a C, because, yes, I mean, the World Series back-to-back appearances in 2014 were tremendous, and 15 was the ultimate highlight. But when you have only four seasons in 20 years with winning records, that takes it down.
How about charities and community work?
A. This, as much as community conscious as the Kauffmans were, I think the Glass family, in a very low-key style, has hit it out of the ballpark.
Embracing Royals tradition.
C. I think the Royals have done some very good things, like last year recognizing the 50 years of the franchise. But I think there are not enough resources that go into activities that involved the tradition, such as we never had a reunion at the ballpark for the 2000, you know, a 30-year anniversary for the 1985 team, an anniversary celebration of the 1980 team, which finally got the Royals to their first World Series. And I think in many ways they've alienated much of their alumni.
Just quickly, Greg, any reason to think that John Sherman's bid to buy the team will not be approved?
I believe it will be approved because he's already a minority owner with the Cleveland Indians. Major League Baseball has already done its due diligence on him, and I think if they didn't think he would have the financial wherewithal, I don't think we would be at this point.
And in 10 seconds, reason to be optimistic under a Sherman ownership than a David Glass, more money being spent on the team?
I think that remains to be seen. He's known in the business community, but the common fan still has a lot to learn about him.
Okay, that's Greg Eklund, a sports reporter for KCRR, talking about the legacy of David Glass. Toby Cook was here, Vice President of Publicity for the Royals. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay. Ever since the team's first meeting in Oakland nearly 60 years ago, the rivalry between the Kansas City Chiefs, we're switching sports here, and the Oakland Raiders has been considered one of the bitterest in the NFL. After this past Sunday, it will never be quite the same. Commentator Victor Wishna explains why in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
On Sunday, the Kansas City Chiefs made what is most likely their final trip to Oakland for one last dance in the dirt. Yeah, really, the dirt. The Oakland Raiders call the Oakland Coliseum home, but they have roommates. Major League Baseball's Oakland A's use it most of the week, and on fall Sundays, they just leave a bunch of their baselines and infield dirt lying around. It's a design quirk that robs the infamous black hole of some of its malevolent majesty. And on paper, this 121st renewal of the rivalry was not a game that had all that much meaning. A second-week matchup with a 7-point spread between the three-time defending division champs and a team that won just 4 games last year. Yet, it was one of those moments in sports when history clashes with history in the making. The Raiders are leaving for Las Vegas after the season, and CBS Sports sent their first-string broadcast team to cover the farewell tour. Before kickoff, Jim Nantz and Tony Romo waxed nostalgic over black-and-white images of the rivalry's epic encounters past. Sure, there was color film in the 60s, but memories just look better in black-and-white. The Raider faithful, meanwhile, were loud and exceedingly faithful, considering that this team has proven, and not for the first time, that it doesn't give a shit about them. But at first, the Raiders were actually scary, driving across the baseball diamond, unchecked. And the Chiefs looked more like the Royals, as for the first time in 23 games, Andy Reid's offense was completely shut out in the first quarter. But that just made them angry. And on the first play of the second quarter, Patrick Mahomes took the snap, somewhere near second base, and lofted it 44 yards to DeMarcus Robinson, who was wide open in front of the visitors' dugout, which I didn't realize at first was also the end zone. Minutes later, Mahomes launched a 42-yard shot from almost the exact same spot, then again from 30 yards, and again from nearly 40. I guess it's no surprise that the former baseball prospect and son of a major leaguer would be perfectly comfortable hurling strikes from the middle of the infield. Indeed, Mahomes' father, Pat, last pitched on this field on the exact same date 24 years ago, 2 days before Patrick II was born. Hey, that means, oh, yeah, happy birthday. Speaking of milestones, Mahomes' 278 passing yards in the second was the most in any single quarter of a regular season NFL game. His 4 TDs, the most in team history. The Raiders, meanwhile, wouldn't score again. So the Chiefs left Oakland for the last time, victorious, and the A's went about putting their furniture back in place. They had to get ready for the Royals, who arrived last night for a 3-game set. Since the Raiders' next home game is until November, when baseball season is over, this was the last game in the dirt. Next year, the team finally takes all their fear and loathing to Las Vegas, where, with significant help from taxpayers, they are shoveling nearly $2 billion into a shiny new black hole. The Las Vegas Raiders just sounds wrong for many reasons. grit and glitz. Sure, there was that brief decade when the Raiders set up shop in L.A., but that just felt like an extended sabbatical. They were always the Oakland Raiders. Andy Reid left the Coliseum Sunday as the winningest head coach in NFL history who hasn't won a championship. As if on cue, CBS flashed a photo of Hank Stram being carried out on his players' shoulders following the last ever AFL championship game, in which the Chiefs beat the Raiders en route to their only Super Bowl win. In some ways, that 50-year-old image seems more present than ever, even though this team has 14 games before the playoffs and a lot more history to make. So we might as well enjoy it. Take it for what it's worth, 'cause we're gonna get some on us when we're playing in the dirt.
Victor Wishin is an editor, writer, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Tomorrow, KCPT's Nick Haynes joins us, but this time, he's the one answering questions. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.